Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Benji Price. He is the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund's National Organizing Director with 15 years' experience organizing communities and coordinating organizers across the country to challenge state and federal legislation of corporate assaults against people and their environments. He pioneered rights of nature legislation in the United States and assisted scores of communities to enact rights-protecting laws. So first, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks a whole lot, Derek. I'm really happy to be here.
So I would like to focus today on your book, How Wealth Rules the World, Saving Our Communities and Freedoms from the Dictatorship of Property. And I have a couple things I'd like to read you from it. First, there's a paragraph from the bottom of the first page of the preface. The plan of this book is to unmask the artifice of democratic representation that American law and the laws of many erstwhile democratic nation mocks in practice. It will expose the way the legal system has been engineered to guarantee that wealth and empire prevail over people and their common birthright. It has been written for anyone who wonders what went wrong in a nation thought to have pioneered a system of democratic representation with rules that apply equal to everyone. And then, on page one of the book, you say, let's get it out in the open. The United States of America and nations that emulate its governing principles are governed by a dictatorship of property. So can you respond to any of that any way you want?
Sure. And I imagine that listeners and folks who read the book will... some of them at first be taken aback by statements like this, because we have this legend about America's founding and about what it's all about. And part of that legend is that the rights of people are paramount, and the reason that we have the Constitution we do is to protect that we, the people, the first two words of the Constitution as it was drafted in 1787. And so to say that the Constitution and the laws of this nation actually don't, their outcome is not to create a society and a system of government that is equally fair to everyone and that respects fundamental rights as the highest principle and the highest law. To say that may be shocking, but the point of the book is to demonstrate that it is just legend, that the fact of the matter is that dictatorship of property is a system of law. It's a self-replicating system of law that actually elevates the rights of those who come into possession of the greatest amount of wealth above the general population. In recent years, since the Occupy Wall Street movement, the terminology, the one major thing I think that came out of that effort was that we're now able to speak about the 99% versus the 1% of the population. And to understand that the people in the United States who are not at the top of that pyramid of wealth aren't really a self-governing population. So the fact is that it's important for people to understand what are those mechanisms. How does the law work? How does it actually come together in a way that prevents us in the communities where we live, from protecting our land base, from protecting the environment, from protecting our own health and safety and that of our children, and beyond that, protecting future generations and the future viability of the earth. You know, how can we do that when the primary interests of the living generation are subordinated to the interest of what's called profit, of the accumulation of more and more, and possession of more and more property? And it's important, I think, that we should talk about what property actually is and how I talk about it in the book, which is a bit different from kind of the colloquial understanding of it, that it's just our possessions, our cars, and the rest of it, because our laws treat different types of property differently, and they treat people and their what's called unalienable rights in the Declaration of Independence. They treat them as really secondary rights to the interest of accumulated property. So that's really the essence of the dictatorship of property that I'm getting at. Getting into the details of how that is held up, how is that system of protecting wealth from democratic oversight and from community governance, that's really the story that I'm wanting to tell in this book.
So a couple of things before we get there. One of them is, I think a lot of people understand on a visceral level that the government, they understand what you're saying on a visceral level. There's mm-hmm. this whole mythology built up that yeah, we have, you know, that this is a government by and of and for the people. But when I used to do a lot of talks, I would routinely ask the audience, is there anybody in here who believes that government takes better care of human beings or of corporations? And out of tens of thousands of people, nobody ever said they believed it takes better care of human beings. So I think mm-hmm. on one level, we kind of get it. And so that I wanted to just sort of throw in, and then you can either respond to that, or you can go to define the different types of property, or you can do both, whatever you want to do.
No, that's fine. Let me try to respond to your question. And it's interesting because I've been involved with community organizing for about 15 years. And when I meet with a community group for the first time, one of the first things I ask them usually is, when it comes to governing decisions that will impact your lives and your local environment, is it you, the people in this room, who will be directly affected, who make those decisions, or is it somebody else? And I've yet to have anyone raise their hand and say, oh, we do it, that we self-govern. And so you're right. I think that viscerally folks understand there's a problem. But where they end up then is to say, well, we know that there's a problem. We know we don't have access to the governing power that would allow us to say no to fracking or to a toxic waste dump or to damming a river, whatever it might be, that the people living in the community and as, you know, maybe stewards of their environment, they don't have the final say. It's not up to them. And then they come to me as a, you know, someone who's hopefully going to help them. And they say, what can we do? My answer isn't that, well, we can fix it for you. It's that we have to challenge the system as it stands and as it operates, because we can't fix anything until we've done that. We have to dismantle the plumbing of the law that makes sure that, you know, all the goodies go to those who already have the privilege in the community and in the society. And what's that process about? Where does it start? How did we end up where we are? That's one of the first questions I ask is, how did we end up at a time and in a place when the people in a community don't have the ability or the authority to say no to things that they know will harm them and they know will harm their habitat and the habitat of all the living things around them? How did we get there? And it's true, we have a legend of democracy in this country. And we have this story about a revolution against the British Empire. And that was a nation and a society, a culture, based on hierarchy, on hereditary power to govern. The legend that we have in our own minds here in this country is that, well, we got rid of that. Somehow we overcame that. We changed it, and there was a Declaration of Independence that argued that the reason that we form governments at all is so that they'll protect the inherent unalienable rights of all people. and that when governments don't do that anymore, we have the not only the authority, but the obligation to change them, to amend them, or to abolish them, and maybe set up a government that does do those things, that protects fundamental rights. And by fundamental rights, I'll just say briefly that let's think of those as the highest values that a community can have. You know, the right that everyone should be treated fairly, the right that we shouldn't destroy the world that we live in and that our lives depend on, and we shouldn't harm the ability of others to enjoy their rights, and that includes future generations. You know, how did we arrive at a point where those principles, those aspirations that were put into a document like the Declaration of Independence, how did we get away from that? And we have a system of government that doesn't look like that at all. And I just want to say that I don't mean to overly romanticize the Declaration, but at the same time, the history is important to understand. And this can be a bit much. There's a lot of details. But that Declaration wasn't something that just hatched out of Thomas Jefferson's brain. A lot of the principles that were put in there were borrowed from 100 years earlier from documents written by the levelers and the diggers, folks who wanted to get rid of the monarchy and the hierarchical structure of society in England. Things like that the people are the source of all governing authority comes right from the levelers. The idea that of no taxation without representation. It was certainly relevant to the American colonies because they did not have representation in Parliament, even if they were, second-class English citizens. They didn't have, in the hierarchical structure, they still did not have even, the appearance of representation in Parliament. So it kind of made sense. It makes sense to us when we talk about it, that was a sentiment right out of the Revolution, when in fact it was borrowed. But the other thing that was borrowed, the most significant thing, was the grievances against the system of hierarchical rule and the idea that people can't make their own laws and can't govern their own communities. And I mean laws that protect their rights and their interests. And where did those ideas come from? There were more than 90 proposals that were sent to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia prior to the Declaration being drafted. And it was 90 statements from 90 different communities, and I mean little towns, counties, gatherings of regular people, well, white men with property, I should say, those regular people, because be clear, nothing to romanticize here. Women didn't have any rights. They were considered the property of husbands or fathers. Native Americans had no rights. They weren't represented. African Americans certainly weren't. No one but white men with property were considered to be the we the people that ended up being talked about in the preamble of the U.S. Constitution. But the Declaration and the grievances that were brought against the king to justify secession from the empire started out with the very first grievance saying that the king, in other words, the empire itself, refuses to allow the people to make laws to protect their interests in their own communities. It wasn't a grievance that the United States couldn't make laws because there was no United States. It wasn't a grievance that the states couldn't make laws because there were no states. It was a complaint that said that the people living here in North America who had displaced the native people, that they were being denied the right of self-determination. The irony being, of course, Native Americans and enslaved women were not allowed to engage in self-determination either. But this is the general principle that is pointed at to lionize the American system. The story that I tell in the book is that even that hypocritical statement I say hypocritical because of the huge proportion of the communities that were not considered to have the right to self-determination. That was simply the fact of it. But there was a change. The declaration occurred. There was a war, and regular people, farmers, put down their tools and picked up muskets and went to fight the redcoats. And when they were done and had to go home and pick up life again and farm and the rest of it, a wealthy group of men met in Philadelphia secretly to draft a new form of government, because they saw the form that had been created during the Revolution. That was the Articles of Confederation, the very first American Constitution. This group of wealthy men that we identify as the Federalists met and drafted a new form of government that would centralize power, remove self-governing authority from the communities, from the states as well, and put into fewer and fewer hands the full decision-making power, and in essence, privatize public government. That's not the story that's generally told in our history classes, but it's the story that I think is important for people to understand, simply to begin to know why they can't make decisions for themselves in the communities where they live today, and frankly, to explain why it's currently illegal to create sustainable communities. It's illegal to protect the environment. It's illegal to protect human rights if they interfere with the privileges of the wealthy minority.
So do you want to talk more about that history, or would you rather also do what you mentioned earlier about defining different types of property?
Well, and if I can do that, I'll try to do it briefly, because I know that it will be a source of contention for some folks. They're very protective. They're concerned that their rights and property might be harmed. That a book like this, if it purports to say that property rights shouldn't be protected by law, I know how concerning that may be. The fact is that we haven't really spent any time in this culture examining what property actually is. And the question is there really such a thing as property? Does it exist in, the empirical world? And I like to use this analogy. We can look at, say, a municipal plat, and we can see the property lines drawn on a map. We can kind of back out from that and look at a state map and see the counties and the towns and the rest of it, and they're all lines drawn on top of a topographical map. And we can back that off and look at nations around the world, and we can see borders and all this talk on the national level of should there be a wall built between the nation of Mexico and the United States. We're talking about borders and boundaries and so forth, and they have everything to do with what property is. And what property is about, it's about creating monopoly control for a minority of people and excluding everyone else from enjoyment of what is called property. When we look from space, the photos from orbit, we can't see any of those boundaries. We can't see any national or state lines or property boundaries. All we can see is the world as it is. And I ask, where does property exist? Where does it come from? I think the answer is it exists on paper, on those maps. And it exists in the minds of people who believe those lines mean something, and in the will of those who have power to defend those lines as though they were real and to enforce them as real. Does that mean that no one should be allowed to have a home because it's not real? That's not actually what I'm getting at. I do make a distinction between private property, which I, in a shorthand, would say that's the property that is created by one's own effort, by an individual's own effort. And what's really owned isn't the property. We borrow the property in our lifetimes, and then when we die, as they say, you can't take it with you. So we're borrowing it for a time, essentially. And why do we have any right to a monopoly control over our yard, for instance? Because that's what it is. You know, no trespassing sign, keep off the grass, all of those things come down to saying that it's for my enjoyment and no one else's. If it's mine, I own it. Well, but that ability to have that access to that plot ground, you know, in general, it historically, it shouldn't be ours. In our lifetimes, again, we use it, we borrow it in usufruct, as it's said in legal terms. It never really belongs to anyone individually, but there is a certain privilege under law that allows the individual, based on them having worked to perhaps, you know, in a field, perhaps to cultivate a farm. And the cultivation is the labor that they've put into it. That's the value that they've brought, and that's the reason they have some claim to it in law. That's an argument that was made around the time of the American Revolution by people like Ben Franklin and Thomas Paine. But it's not the way that it was seen by the Federalists. They believed in a thing that I call privileged property, and that's the ability to accumulate property without limit. Essentially, it's the model of empire. It's the ability to monopolize not just land, by the way, but you know what's called resources and human labor, the ability to call slaves, property of slave owners at the time of the adoption of the U.S. Constitution was an expression of the idea of privileged property, that slave's labor did not belong to the slave human being. The human enslaved person did not own their own labor, their own effort. We find that to exist today in terms of debt, that people who sign contracts to borrow money under certain terms, student loan debt is a horrible current example of it, can find that they owe large portions of their future, the value of their future labor, to people that they've borrowed from. And so there's a property interest in that human labor. That's a type of what I would call privileged property. And what it all comes down to is really not a measure of property, but is there, can labor be owned? Is labor a commodity? Is the work of another person able to become the property of someone else? In other words, is servitude something that we value and that we should make laws to protect the owners of that servitude? And the Federalists said, yes, absolutely. And we would not only say yes, but we want to build a whole legal system on the premise of ownership of that special type of wealth. And they did it. They did it. Things like the Three-Fifths Clause. Derek, the Three-Fifths Clause, for folks that don't maybe haven't looked at the Constitution for a while, it was put in place at the time of the Constitution's drafting. And it said that states that allow ownership of slaves will get more representation in government based on counting each of the slaves that have no rights of their own, but counting the slaves as 3/5 of a person, as 60% of a human being, when it came around to doing the census, and then proportionally allotting representation in Congress and in the electoral college that chooses the president. So that slave states and owners of slaves actually had more governing rights, more governing privileges than the rest of the people who were ostensibly being represented in Congress. That's one example, earlier example of privileged property and the lodging of privileges to govern within property itself. And that's an important concept. And it's one that has carried over to the present day, where corporate property, property that is simply, it's words on paper is what a corporation is. But corporations have been deemed to have the same Bill of Rights protections as other human beings. And that is another way to lodge rights, and particularly governing rights, within property, so that those extra privileges, that extra power to govern, is conveyed to whoever comes into possession of the privileged property. Have I lost you on this?
No. I'm thinking a few things, and this is sort of, these are some responses to the whole discussion, as opposed to anything at the end. Mm-hmm. There's three things. One of them is that I live in bear territory, and I see bears quite often, and bears will have and people talk about this all the time, bears will have a territory. Mm-hmm. And I think about this in terms of you know, we talk about sometimes, well, all I'm saying is that bears, wolves, prairie dogs will have a home territory that is theirs, and they will, or salmon, when they go to spawn, you know, they'll make a little nest, and if anybody else tries to take the nest, I mean, this is my nest that I'm gonna reproduce in. Mm-hmm. So there's that. That's one thing. And the next thing is, back when I used to teach at Eastern Washington University, I had a student once who was very right wing and he was a small timber mill owner who had been put out of business by Weyerhaeuser. So on one hand, he's really he's very pro logging, but he also hated the big corporations. And he and I had some really interesting conversations. You know, I come at this from this extreme environmental perspective that, you know, all industrial logging is bad. And he and I worked out this sort of theoretical compromise that we thought it would be okay for people to log anywhere within, I don't know, 200 yards of their home. But you should not be able to own property more than 200 yards from where you actually live, and you should not be able to log more than 200 yards from where you live, because you can't hurt somebody else's home. If you're stupid enough to destroy your own home, I mean, there's obviously, I don't agree with all of this, because of course the trees have their own perspective on this, but the point is there's a difference between where you live and also owning property that is a mile away or 10,000 miles away or 1,000 miles away and destroying somebody else's home. And then the third thing is, I remember having this conversation with an American Indian once who said that on their reserve, it's up in Canada, First Nations person, on their reserve, people can build houses where they want, but the thing is, when you die, the house does not pass on. It's as you, exactly as you said, you don't own the land, you don't own the house. I mean, you do own the house for the time, you know, somebody else can't just break into your house at 2 o'clock in the morning and decide they're going to sleep in your bed. But when you die, it's communal. I don't know how they transfer it. I don't know that. But what I do know is you don't own the land. Anyway, right. Those are just some things that I'm just sort of throwing out as responses to everything you said.
Right. And I don't, nothing I've said contradicts the idea of the bears and other animals having territory, or humans having some territory. Many years ago, I know it probably was in high school, when I read Robert R. Dre's The Territorial Imperative. It's all about animal behavior and how they actually do establish territory. But it's not a parallel exactly with the idea of property, I would say.
Wait, I think the property, what the point I was really trying to get at with all that is, mm-hmm. there's something called the toxic mimic that takes the form and perverts the intent of something. I think that property is a toxic mimic of the territorial imperative. That's what I was really trying to get to.
I get it. Yeah, and I'd agree with you on that. In terms of, you know, that you should only be able to, say, cut trees or mine or withdraw water or whatever within a certain radius of your living territory, what you actually need to survive and the rest of it, there's some logic to that. What we have, though, with this mimicry of the territorial imperative, I'm sorry, what kind of mimicry is it again?
Toxic.
Toxic, yes, exactly. What we have isn't just the claim of, well, for now, I'm going to use this field because I need to grow crops, and you know, the rest of the community is going to nod and say, yeah, that's okay, because we want the same kind of leeway to do that. I mean, we're going back to the idea of the commons. And what we have once the commons were privatized, or as they called it in England, the enclosure movement, which was about telling communities of people where no one had a piece of paper saying, I have title to this land, having armed men walk in and say, you have a choice. You can stay and be a servant, a serf, a slave, to the new owner, the baron so-and-so, and we're putting up a fence and a wall around this land, and that belongs now to, you know, his lordship. And if you stay, then you're going to pay, you're going to give some of your crops, maybe a lot of it, to the new lord. And if you don't agree to that, then get the hell out. That was a privatization of land that was not owned by anyone prior to that point. And, you know, the First Nations people, I know they had territories, they lived in certain areas, and yes, there were sometimes conflicts over that, but they didn't have laws that said that there was an exclusionary right of the owner of this chunk of land that eliminates the ability of anyone else to cross it without permission, to do anything on it without the owner's okay. And going to, I think, your third point about, you know, using that land then during your living years and not having it passed on to inheritors and so forth, which was Britain and not just England's way, but it was a means for centralizing power and control over large swaths of the earth, was to turn it into hereditary property. Tom Paine, who wrote Common Sense and inspired the American Revolution, and was a real radical. He believed that the hierarchy of the empire was foolish, and he wrote about it, how silly it was that it was not grounded in anything but simple brute coercion. And he came up with a plan that he wrote about. You know, he wrote a lot, and he wrote, besides Common Sense, he wrote a paper called Agrarian Justice that actually mapped out a way for use of land to be, yes, protected during the lifetime of the user, but then for that to be recognized as a borrowing from the larger community that would be repaid at death. You know, it's the right wingers love to say that the inheritance tax is a death tax. It's a funny thing. You know, in this country, the inheritance tax only applies to people that that die owning an awful lot of money, and it's then a small pittance of compared to, you know, the portion of the wealth that they have that would be taken as a tax. Paine's proposal was somewhat different, and it was a way to set up a system of kind of a social security system so that there would be a source of funds for people who were ill, for people who were old and not able to work anymore. And it would be the folks who had during life enjoyed the use of the land for the value of that to come back to the community, rather than to simply be passed on to some, you know, lucky child who was born into the right family. That's an idea that carries some merit. And it's, I think, we don't do ourselves any favors by not being familiar with that part of the American Revolution, the truly radical side of it, that had it been followed, we might have gotten quite different results. But in terms of using the land, one of the problems we have with the property system and our inability to protect the natural world is that the people who own land under the law today have the legal privilege, and I refuse to say right, that's a different thing, but they have the legal privilege to destroy that ecosystem for their own profit, regardless of what impact that has on future generations, regardless of what harm that does to the surrounding community. They have the legal authority to do it. Right? Environmentalists wonder why they can't seem to gain ground and protect the environment. You know, yes, there's been over the years some efforts, and they're to be applauded, and it's a good thing some of them happened. But you know, the Clean Water Act has not saved our waters. The Clean Air Act has not saved the air or the climate. What it does is it slows down the rate of destruction. And that rate of destruction is regulated. That's what regulations do. And the destruction itself is legalized with the issuance of permits. But what we don't have is the ability to actually protect the natural world or our own communities or future generations. Because of this idea that the rights that are sewn up in property and then handed over to those who possess that property are superior to human rights, civil rights, community rights, rights of nature, that privileged property rights, the rights that are actually, they are invested in property itself, just like corporate rights. Those legal rights are vested in the property itself. And the property then becomes, it's almost like a magic talisman or something. Once you come into possession of it, you've got all the magic powers. And your magic powers mean you can make money with it any way you want, and you can destroy it any way you want to. And no one under the law has the authority to stop you.
So I'm thinking a couple things. One of them is that, you know, this whole system just, it has its internal logic, but it doesn't, when you think about it in the ways you're expressing, it doesn't make any sense. That if you think about this in a family, you know, little Jane has her toy and little Johnny has his toy. And if little Johnny, for no reason, steals little Janie's toy, then they run to mommy and daddy, and mommy and daddy tell Johnny to give Janie back her toy, that she has that. But the problem is not that she has a toy. The problem is that within the system, the things that are declared to be one person's, it's like you say, the biggest words on the back of your book are one right to rule them all. So it's as though, you know, Janie's ownership of this toy then suddenly trumps the fact that the entire house is on fire, or trumps all social relationships. There are times when it's appropriate for Janie to share her toy with Johnny, or vice versa. The thing I'm getting at is I love the line. I love the fact that you've got one right to rule them all in such huge letters. And so can you talk a bit more about the word we used in the very beginning of this interview? And by the way, we have about 10 minutes left. Can you talk a little bit about the dictatorship of property? Not just the existence of property, but the dictatorship. That's in my mind key to everything in your book.
Right. By the way, if you're not, you may not be familiar, but one right to rule them all is a little bit of a takeoff from that the story, The Lord of the Rings. One ring to rule them all.
Of course.
And I believe it's the introduction. The title is one right to rule them all. The dark side of property. And I think we have to go back to, again, where property comes from, you know, that those imaginary lines don't exist in the empirical world. But all of the philosophy that we have back to the so-called Enlightenment era that was really, you know, a lot of ideas about property being such a fundamental right and so forth come from that era and borrowed from, you know, the Old Testament, you know, that man, God told man that, you know, you'll have dominion over the world and do with what you want and so forth. But talk about things going toxic. You know, what happened really was you look at those philosophers and so many of them were apologists for empire, for the global expansion of European empire. It was a way to justify the conquistadors or the British marching in and decimating the people living there, acting as though they weren't there or had no right to be there, and just taking it for themselves. Where does property come from? It comes from that kind of aggression. It means throwing some people off the land and taking it for yourself. Janie might have got the doll as a present, you know, so it's not that's not a perfect analogy for it. You know, but if her brother Bobby runs out and steals a bike and then Janie wants to play with it, we might have a little bit closer analogy to what's going on in the world today.
Right.
The how does wealth rule the world? Well, how is there a dictatorship of property? It's built right into our system of government, laced into the Constitution of the United States that illegally, unconstitutionally overthrew the Articles of Confederation. And it was done secretly. And the notes from that meeting were not made public until two generations after the Constitution had been in effect. But we can find in it things that look pretty innocuous, like the Commerce Clause that says that Congress will have the power to regulate trade between the states with foreign nations and with the Indian tribes, is the way it says it. We have the Contracts Clause that says that the states, local governments too, will not and they shall not impair the obligation of contract. Which there are two examples out of the Constitution that they're not public law, they're private law. It's saying that Congress will make decisions about what happens between two businesses or between a customer and, you know, they didn't use this terminology then, but essentially when it came down to it, if the central government wanted to decide how commerce will proceed, it has the sole authority to make that decision. No longer do the states, no longer does your community have the right to say, we're not going to sell GMO foods in our community. We reserve the right to say no to it. You know, how is it possible that today you can be sued for saying we won't sell your GMO foods in our grocery store in this little town? Because you'll be violating the rights of the corporation if you do. Well, what about the rights of the people to decide what they want in their community as to be called food? That right has been trumped by the property interests of the corporation, with the blessing of the judiciary, which looks at what the Federalists put in play and looks at it and says, we're preserving that at all costs. The court system that we have is, its primary power is to preserve the status quo, and the tool it uses prior court decisions. It has the authority to say, the precedent says this, we're not changing precedent. In other words, there is a self-preserving mechanism that ensures that those rich white guys who wrote our form of government, that what they wanted to happen will happen even these many years later, and that the living generation will not be able to contradict or change that. It is a dictatorship of property because property was put at the head of the class. The authority of people to use their wealth. when they enter into contracts will not be interfered with by local or state governments. Why? Because supposedly that's private law, not public law. Public law, we can make laws about barking dogs and speed limits and things like that, but we can't make laws about what people do with their wealth, because that's private law and nobody's business but the people who have the property. So we blithely use terms like the private sector and the public sector and never ask ourselves, what does that mean? You know, we have this, you know, kind of knot in our stomachs when we see some wealthy guy commit some crime that's harmed so many people and get off almost scot-free, or scot-free, and we see some kid who got caught with a joint spending a long time behind bars. Why is that? Why is there a different legal system for different classes of people? And the fact is, we got rid of hereditary wealth and we substituted it with this idea of vesting property itself with rights, so that it's not a bloodline, it's really the bottom line. Whoever gets to own the most has the most in terms of rights. And they are a minority, and they dictate what the policies, public policies, will be, immune from public governance.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and I have a two-part question and a wind-down question, so we'll have to go pretty quickly. And the two-part question is, so if we had a massive voters revolt where we all voted differently, but we didn't do anything else, okay? So mm-hmm. we throw all the bums out and we put a bunch of other bums in. Mm-hmm. And all these new bums, they vote that it's no longer legal to pollute rivers at all, or it's no longer legal to – they vote to give Congress, United States Congress, votes to give communities the rights to determine whether somebody's going to frack in that community. So if they did that, are you saying that the Supreme Court would then probably overturn that, because in the Constitution itself – it reserves that right to Congress, and they'd say that that is an unconstitutional law?
Well, yeah.
With neither of us being legal scholars.
No, I would predict that that's exactly what would happen, that there would be a lawsuit brought. It's what happens in the communities that I work in and my colleagues at Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund work at, that we go in, we work with a community, they pass a law that says no fracking, and then there's a lawsuit, and the court decides that, as much as democracy would be a really great idea, you can't make that law, because that law, we have prior court decisions, we have precedent that says, no, you can't have it. And again, the status quo is preserved. You know, Tom Lindsay uses an analogy I like a lot, so I'll borrow it from, it's like a self-sealing tire. Every time that the people try to puncture it to take the air out of it, it seals itself and rolls right along. So electing the right people, you know, there are better people in terms of their, you know, their idea of what a democracy is and so forth. But you can't just change the people. You can't change the names on the door, you know, and expect that the system is going to change because they have a better, more humane attitude, because they're constrained by the system as well.
So that leads us to really sort of our next to last question, which is, so what those of us who care about community rights, those of us who care about life on Earth, those of us who care about justice, what do we do?
Well, one thing that we can't do is be complicit in the system as it is. And I say we can't. Of course, you have the choice to live under this system. But I think that that implies that we have the right not to pass the system on improved for the next generation. Otherwise, we're dooming the kids, the grandkids, to have to fight instead, because we just found reasons not to. When I say fight, I mean it means standing and opposing the system. One of the tools that I've been using for the past 15 years is working with communities to challenge the particular laws, the particular legal doctrines, Dillon's rule that says that local municipalities have no authority of their own to protect the community living there, that that's up to the state, and then the federal government saying, and the states can't stop rich people from doing what they want. You know, if we don't stand up and say, we're going to govern ourselves, and then actually do it, not write articles about it necessarily, and I write a lot of articles about it and say we ought to do these things, but we actually get out and do it, and we end up in court, and we end up not always winning, that's for sure. What we really need, in my estimation, is a mass movement, a people's movement that takes on the system and refuses cooperation and begins to govern in their own communities like freedom and liberty of choice matter and self-determination and the responsibility to protect our families and our land base are real and not just say, well, we can't fight City Hall. And a mass movement of that sort has not yet begun. We keep trying to model it. We need to have the word get out. And just like other efforts of people to gain rights that have been denied, civil rights movement, there was a lot of challenging of unjust law. And challenging it publicly is one way to educate other people, to let them see the nature of the injustice, because it's hidden in plain sight otherwise. We need to challenge it and allow the system to come back and say, you can't have those rights because they're reserved for special people. We need to make that very plain, and the only way to do it is to confront the injustice.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. And before we finish, I want to say once again that your book is How Wealth Rules the World, Saving Our Communities and Freedoms from the Dictatorship of Property. So I would like to thank you for being on the program, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Ben Price. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.